What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
An official source tells Press TV that only the removal of all U.S. sanctions can salvage the ongoing nuclear talks in Vienna. Iran's intelligence ministry releases the picture of the perpetrator of the recent terror act at the Natanz nuclear facility. And Yemen's army says it's attacked a major airbase in Saudi Arabia's Hamas Mashhad with explosive drones. Hello and welcome from Tehran. You've tuned into World News. I'm Isaiah Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, Iran's deputy foreign minister says a new understanding is being reached among parties to the 2015 nuclear deal. Abbas Araghchi says negotiations have come to a level where parties can start working on a text based on their common interests. Araghchi, however, spoke of serious disagreements that have to be addressed during the upcoming negotiations. Iranian officials also stressed that Tehran is not interested in prolonged discussions. Negotiators from Iran and the remaining signatories to the agreement have completed another round of talks in Vienna in a bid to revive the landmark agreement. Our correspondent in Vienna, Homolinsky, says all the participants in the talks share the same objective of getting the U.S. to rejoin the nuclear deal, which requires the removal of sanctions on Iran.
The Joint Commission meeting was held today in the Austrian capital, Vienna. That meeting has now ended with statements being made by various parties. The Chinese ambassador first said that Beijing insists that all U.S. sanctions imposed on Iran, both the primary sanctions and the secondary ones involving third parties and making it hard for third-party entities or companies to work with Iran, should immediately be lifted for the JCPOA to have a chance to be revived. Also, Enrico Mora, the EU representative who was leading the talks alongside Iran's Abbas Araghchi, Mr. Mora also tweeted that he believes that progress is being made, although the path forward is not an easy one. And the Russian envoy, Mikhail Oryanov, also said that the sides have decided to continue with technical and legal discussions on the list of measures that need to be taken by Iran in order to come back to full compliance, as well as a list of sanctions that need to be removed by the U.S. So he said that these discussions are going to continue to this evening, also Sunday, and throughout the next week, because the sides don't want to waste any time, and there is a sense of urgency, and they want to get things done as quickly as possible to be able to have the U.S. back in the deal. I think the message here was that all the parties involved in these talks agree that they have the same objective, and that is getting the U.S. to join the JCPOA, rejoin the JCPOA, that is, and that means the removal of sanctions.
Meanwhile, informed sources say the removal of all U.S. sanctions is the only way to salvage the Vienna talks from collapse. Sources told Press TV that dividing the sanctions into removable, irremovable, and negotiable is not acceptable to Iran. The source noted that the EU's recent sanctions on Iran's top commanders amount to a clear violation of the 2015 deal. Iran's intelligence ministry has released a picture of a man behind the recent sabotage incident at the country Natanz nuclear facility. Ministry has identified the perpetrator as Reza Kadimi. He fled the country before the attack that Iran blames on Israel. The intelligence ministry says all necessary and legal steps for his arrest and return to the country are underway. Tehran says the act of sabotage was prompted by the Israeli regime's anger over diplomatic efforts to revive the Iran nuclear deal. Sabotage on last Sunday disrupted the flow of power at the Natanz facility, causing a blackout there. Iranian officials have said that the attack did not cause any disruption to the enrichment process and that the damaged centrifuges will be replaced with more advanced ones. Moving on to other news this hour, the Yemeni army says it has performed a successful drone strike against a sensitive military target at Saudi Arabia's King Khalid Air Base. Yemeni Army spokesman Yahya Sadi said the strike was conducted by a Qassam 2K drone. The attack was in response to Saudi Arabia's escalation of aggression and its continued siege of Yemen. Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a deadly war on Yemen in 2015 to reinstate a friendly regime there. Yemeni forces have escalated retaliatory attacks. They are pushing for the lifting of a blockade and a halt to the aggression. The escalation comes amid increasing pressure from the international community on Saudi Arabia to end the war. Meanwhile, Yemenis are marking the holy month of Ramadan amid the ongoing conflict, siege, and rising prices. The economic situation doesn't allow two-thirds of the population to access or afford enough food. Abdul Latif Al-Washandi brings us more from Sana'a.
The seventh holy month of Ramadan since the start of the war on Yemen has arrived, and Yemeni struggle continues. The rising cost of living makes shopping for essentials a difficult task, as most Yemenis depend on daily wages.
We're going through a harsh economic condition. The ongoing blockade and war imposed by the Saudi-led coalition have put us in deep troubles. We hardly earn our livelihood and can't afford to buy food for Ramadan.
Tradesmen say they didn't earn much this year due to severe fuel crisis that led to the rising of prices of foodstuffs. Meanwhile, deteriorating economic condition has forced many companies to discharge thousands of their employees.
The purchasing power of people in Yemen has weakened significantly. The prices are rising because the Saudi-led coalition is still preventing entry of oil ships to Yemen. We are suffering greatly from the ongoing war and blockade.
Yemen is on the brink of famine and facing the world's worst humanitarian crisis, according to the United Nations, since Saudi-led coalition backed by Washington launched a devastating war on the war-ravaged nation at the beginning of 2015.
Despite the tragic humanitarian situation in their country, Yemenis welcome Ramadan with hopes of an end to war. They say their army's escalation of retaliatory attacks is pushing Riyadh further into a political solution. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Well, Palestinians have slammed the United Arab Emirates over congratulating Israel on its so-called Independence Day, an occasion considered by Palestinians as a catastrophe, marking the beginning of their displacement from their homeland in 1948. Mona Kandu reports.
The United Arab Emirates has sparked anger among Palestinians by congratulating Israel on its so-called Independence Day, declared in 1948. The occasion is marked by Palestinians as the beginning of their displacement from their homeland. They view the day as the Nakba, or Catastrophe Day.
What Israelis are marking is the day of our catastrophe, the day Palestinians were slaughtered by Zionist gangs. Hundreds of thousands of them were displaced from their homes and lands. The UAE should have sent a message to condemn the daily crimes and oppression committed by the Israeli soldiers as settlers against the Palestinians.
The UAE Embassy in Tel Aviv published a tweet wishing a happy Independence Day to the citizens of Israel, posting a photo of the Israeli and Emirati flags side by side. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu replied by thanking the UAE.
The UAE has not only normalized ties with Israel, but also raised the ties to a new level. The UAE is also becoming Israel's partner in its aggression against the Palestinian people. The congratulation message comes as Israel is preventing Palestinians from entering the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
The UAE was among the first Arab countries to agree to normalize ties with Israel in 2020 under the so-called Abraham Accords, a pact brokered by former U.S. President Donald Trump. Bahrain, Morocco, and Sudan signed normalization deals with the Israeli regime shortly afterwards. Palestinians have angrily slammed normalization of ties between Israel and Arab states, including UAE. They say that since then, those states have been continuing to reward the regime and giving up the Holy Lands. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Ukrainian Foreign Ministry says Russia had briefly detained one of its diplomats in St. Petersburg in the latest flare-up of tensions between the two neighbors. According to the Ukrainian ministry, Russia's Federal Security Service detained Alexandra Sosinyuk for a few hours. The ministry said the diplomat is now back in the country's consulate. The Russian media had also reported that the Ukrainian diplomat was taken into custody when he was trying to obtain classified information about Russian law enforcement databases during a meeting with a Russian citizen. Tensions between Moscow and Kiev have been rising, and also clashes have been taking place in eastern Ukraine between the army and pro-Russia forces. Well, tensions are running high between the United States and Russia. The two superpowers have imposed sanctions on one another, bringing their bilateral ties to a new low since the Cold War. Russia has unveiled counter-sanctions against the U.S. by expelling and banning current and former U.S. officials. Moscow has also warned Washington to back away from confrontation.
The United States under President Joe Biden has taken a tougher stance against Russia. On Thursday, Biden said Washington is facing a national emergency, accusing Russia of interference in the 2020 U.S. presidential election and involvement in a major cyber espionage operation. Biden signed an executive order imposing sweeping sanctions against several Russian individuals and institutions, requiring the Treasury Department to block U.S. financial institutions from purchasing bonds from the Central Bank of the Russian Federation, the National Wealth Fund of the Russian Federation, or the Ministry of Finance of the Russian Federation after June 14, and from lending funds to these institutions. Also, the U.S. said it's expelling 10 personnel from Russia's diplomatic mission, claiming that some of them are representatives of intelligence services. But at the same time, the U.S. president called for de-escalation with Russia.
The way forward is through thoughtful dialogue and diplomatic process. The U.S. is prepared to continue constructively to move toward that process. My bottom line is this. Where there's an interest in the United States to work with Russia, we should and we will. If Russia seeks to violate the interests of the United States, we will respond.
Shortly after the announcement, the North Atlantic Council, the political decision-making body within NATO, released a statement in support of the U.S. measures.
Well, it seems to me that it's more appropriate, and probably has been done, for the Russians to declare a national emergency, because they are the ones that are threatened, not the U.S. The U.S. is intervening in a crisis which it helped to create through the support given during the Obama years to the color revolution in Ukraine, which was directed primarily against Russia on behalf of the Western intelligence forces, who felt, in the words of Brzezinski, that if Russia loses Ukraine, they become very weak.
The developments come amid heightened tensions in eastern Ukraine, where pro-Russian forces and the Ukrainian military have clashed in recent weeks.
Well, the United States and its NATO allies are angered by Russian military buildup near the Ukraine border. Moscow argues that the troop and military hardware deployment are aimed at ensuring Russian security. That's no threat to anyone. The situation has become so tense that former U.S. Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard is wondering if Americans are prepared to see their loved ones burned alive in a nuclear holocaust in a war with Russia over Ukraine.
Moscow said it will ban a string of top officials from U.S. President Joe Biden's administration, including his chief domestic policy advisor, Susan Rice, from entering Russia. The Russian Foreign Ministry said U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland, FBI Chief Christopher Wray, Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, and several other officials will be barred. The ministry said the officials participated in the anti-Russian push of the U.S. politics. The U.S. ambassador to Moscow is also being asked to leave the country.
President Vladimir Putin's top foreign policy aide, Yuri Ushakov, has recommended that U.S. envoy John Sullivan leave for Washington to conduct serious consultations.
Lavrov said Russia would ask 10 U.S. diplomats to leave the country in a tit-for-tat move. He said the activity of American funds and NGOs in Russia that interfere in the country's internal affairs would also be seized. Lavrov added that Moscow is also considering, quote, painful measures against U.S. businesses in Russia.
The policy as it's now formed is aimed at really reducing Russia as a major power. They're doing it primarily economically, but also I think what they want is they will not accept a Russia led by Vladimir Putin, but they want regime change. So it's really to undermine, to create a world in which the United States sets the rules.
It appears that the U.S. and Russia are heading towards another Cold War. The possible crisis, however, could prove even costlier than the first for both sides.
Well, the global death toll of COVID-19 has passed a grim milestone of 3 million. Almost one in every five deaths has occurred in the United States, the world's worst-hit country. Brazil, Mexico, India, and the UK come next. Over the past few days, Brazil has been reporting the most fatalities globally, while India has seen the biggest new case numbers. On Monday, the World Health Organization warned that the pandemic is at a critical point. The UN body has also expressed concerns regarding the inequitable rollout of coronavirus vaccines. It complained that some rich nations are stockpiling jabs at the cost of other countries. Well, Iran has registered over 21,000 new coronavirus infections as the country is wrestling with the fourth wave of the pandemic. The health ministry has confirmed 319 more related fatalities. Iran has seen a spike in its daily cases and deaths over the past weeks following the New Year holidays. The spread of the more contagious strand of the virus has also been blamed for the surge. Officials have warned of tougher days ahead and urged the public to observe health regulations. Iran has imposed a two-week lockdown across most of the country. Well, Iran has also been importing vaccines and preparing to begin the mass production of domestic jabs in days. The country has reported over 2.2 million infections and more than 66,000 deaths. Myanmar's security forces have clashed with anti-coup protesters in the country's second-largest city of Mandalay. Protesters took to the streets to voice support for the National Unity Government. Opponents of Myanmar's junta, including ousted members of parliament and leaders of anti-coup protests, announced the formation of a shadow government on Friday. Myanmar has been in turmoil since the army toppled the de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi in a coup back in February. The military argued that the November election last year, won by Suu Kyi's party, was fraudulent. The junta has since intensified its crackdown on anti-coup protesters. According to a Myanmar-based monitoring group, over 700 civilians have been killed during the protests. And with that, that brings us to the end of this World News Edition. Thanks so much for staying tuned.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The month of Allah presents Ahkam, Islamic Commandments of Fasting by Hujjatul Islam Khakdaman.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajeem. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. In the name of God, hello and welcome to our program. I'm very happy to have the chance to talk to you again about the Ahkam of month of Ramadan. This is our program called The Month of Allah, and I'll be continuing to talk about the specific and really special Ahkam needed for us to know about this month. Previously, I was talking about things that will break your fasting. We talked about eating and drinking, which you need to prevent yourself from doing those. You need to be aware of the intercourse that it breaks your fasting. And the third thing is masturbation. Masturbation means an activity that you intentionally stimulate yourself, and it leads to, you know, coming semen out of your body. It breaks your fast, but since this is haram and the consequences are much more, you need to be much more aware of that. Sometimes the semen comes out of body naturally, like when we sleep and we wake up. A lot of young people, we don't call that masturbation. In the religion's language, we call that ihtilam, which is all right, which is a normal process of the body. But if intentionally you do that, something that we call masturbation, it is going to ruin your fasting and it breaks it. And it's going to be very hard for you to, you know, make up for it. Because after the month, you need to do the atonement because you have broken your fasting by something haram, and you need to fast 60 days because of this specific just thing that you did, sin that you committed in the period of your fasting. The next thing that breaks your fast is lying, you know, putting lies on to the Prophet or Ahlul Bayt or the other prophets. By putting lies, I mean, you know, we have heard a lot in our lives that some people quote the sentences or some accounts from the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, or from Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them all. And afterwards, they try to show that this sentence is a lie, or they have lied, they don't know the truth. This is the action, or this is the kind of activity that we call putting lies on somebody. Now, this activity is a huge sin, and doing that in this month is clearly going to break your fast, and it's going to have the consequences for you. The important thing is, sometimes we are not sure about the fact that somebody said something about the Ahlul Bayt, and is it true, is it not? Am I saying something that really Ahlul Bayt and the Holy Prophet, peace be upon them, have said, or they have not said this? And I'm putting lies on them. Or they have said it. I coded, and afterwards I tried to show that it was a lie. No, if you are not sure about what you heard, whether what you heard was right or not, whether it was a quotation from the Ahlul Bayt and the Prophets, peace be upon them all. If you are not sure, you need to code. You need to, no, it is really important. Say that my friend said this. Say that my teacher said this. Quoted. The sentence was from somebody else. Don't say it by yourself. Don't say the sentence like it is your faith. It is your belief. It's a correct sentence. And I'm saying myself and I believe it. And I'm relying on it. Don't say it like this. Quote it. Say that my friend said like this. Is it right? Is it wrong? It's on his shoulders, not mine. So first thing, coaching is very important. The second thing is that we need to be, when we are talking about Ahlul Bayt, we are talking about the traditions of them, we need to be sure that we have gone to the correct books, we have received the correct accounts, and we are talking about what Ahlul Bayt and the Holy Prophets, peace be upon them all, have said. Thank you so very much. I'll be with you. We will continue our program. Goodbye.
Africa Today.
hundreds of Ethiopian immigrants landed in Tel Aviv in March as part of an aggressive move by the Israeli regime to change the demographics of the occupied territories and further push Palestinians out of their land. These Ethiopians face constant discrimination and racism in Israel. An Ethiopian immigrant in the occupied territories speaks out here during an anti-racism protest. Let's take a listen.
We can tell that no one sees us. No one investigates these issues deeply. They always sweep this issue under the carpet.
Hello and a warm welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today, which is focusing on the recent immigration of Ethiopian Jews to Israel and the discrimination they face in the occupied territories. Now, in the second segment of our program, we shall go to the Congo Basin and have a look at the dangers the rainforest in this region is facing. So join us till the end of our show.
Ethiopian Jews face racism in Israel. Some 300 Ethiopian immigrants landed in Tel Aviv in mid-March as part of a colonial plan by the Israeli regime to bring Ethiopian Jewish community to the occupied territories. They were the last of 2,000 Ethiopian immigrants to arrive in an operation which began last December. Nearly 150,000 Ethiopian Jews now live in Israel. Many arrived in a secret immigration operation that took place in the mid-1980s and early 1990s. Most of these Ethiopian Jews face racism in their daily lives and experience institutional discrimination at every level. Even their Jewishness is doubted. This comes as no surprise, as Israel is an apartheid regime.
In 2019, a trigger-happy Israeli policeman shot dead Solomon Teka, a teenager of Ethiopian descent, sparking nationwide protests. One of the protesters expresses fear of daily racist attacks.
I have small kids. This is enough. It's not nice. I'm always worried about my son until I see him with my own eyes when he comes home. Aren't we also humans?
The policeman who shot dead Teka was recently allowed to resume duty. The family of Teka voiced shock and astonishment over his return.
Such incidents are clear evidence that the racist Israeli regime does not really care about Ethiopian Jews, who are being used as part of its long-term strategy to change the demographic makeup of the occupied territories. This plan also includes constructing illegal settlements, destroying historical sites, and expelling the local Palestinian population.
For more on this subject, we contacted Dr. Louis Gordon, the founder of the Center for Afro-Jewish Studies. He's also a professor and head of the Department of Philosophy at the University of Connecticut. Thanks a lot, Dr. Gordon, for your time. Now, as we know, Ethiopian Jews have lived in Ethiopia for centuries. Now, why is the Israeli regime now encouraging them to immigrate to the occupied territories?
You see, although the initial issue was around Jewish Ethiopian refugees, which is part of the Operation Moses situation, if you look at Wings of Dove, this is where you have an unabashedly right-wing government of Israel, and the purposes there are a little different, and the numbers are not as large. So the thing to bear in mind is that there are Ethiopian Jews all over the world. There are prominent intellectuals, prominent activists, all the way down to the working class individual, from the cab driver to the person in the store, and there are varieties of reasons. What's unfortunate is their cause has been captured by the by the conflicts that are really focused more in Israel. But for Ethiopian Jews, for instance, I'm of a variety of Jewish descent, from Mizrahi, from Palestine and Jerusalem, to Sephardic Jews, but also part of my ancestry's Ethiopian Jews. And these are Jews who were in Jamaica. So not all Jews in the world are Jews who want to go to Israel.
Thanks for that, Mr. Gordon, and stay tuned for more.
Ethiopians have long complained about unfair treatment and police violence in Israel and say they're treated as third-class citizens. Bags of blood donated by Ethiopian Jews were found dumped by Israel in 1996. The discovery led to protests and riots in Israel. An Ethiopian demonstrating against discrimination and Israeli police brutality could not mince his words.
I have lots of friends who the police have hit and targeted with tasers. Yesterday it was him, tomorrow it could be me, and the day after it could be my brother or a friend. Why do they do this? Because they're racists.
Ethiopian Jews are now facing discrimination in Israel. Now, do you think they would have been better off staying in Ethiopia?
The thing we have to deal with is that not only are there black Jews everywhere, but we face ongoing struggles even in Israel. Because, I mean, we can't pretend. I mean, there is racism in Israel. And I should add that the Israeli left, as do the U.S. left, join in protest against the discrimination. But the fact is, they're protesting because the discrimination exists, and especially when you talk about the police. But as we know, a big problem of black people in countries that are not predominantly black is this problem of state representatives of violence. And that's why I bring up the police, although if you bring up the Israeli case, you'll also have to bring up the military.
The Israeli regime has also illegally attempted to control the birth rate among Ethiopian immigrants. This racist regime admitted it gave Ethiopian Jewish immigrants birth control injections without their knowledge or consent. Now, why did the Israeli regime forcibly inject Ethiopian women immigrants with birth control shots? This is clearly a criminal move.
The fact of Israeli misdeeds and Ethiopian Jews has been known for decades. Not only in terms of what they're doing with birth control, but the thing is, what's very tricky is an issue that Ethiopian Jews face also when they migrate, not only in Israel, in terms of their numbers.
The Israeli regime also seeks strategic relationships with African governments, while the marginalization of Africans persists within the occupied territories. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is pursuing a plan to deport thousands of African migrants in his racist anti-migrant campaign. He called these African migrants infiltrators. Netanyahu has issued racist remarks against African migrants. What motivates Ethiopian Jews to migrate to the occupied territories while they clearly know they will face racial discrimination?
We're talking also about a right-wing government. I don't know any right-wing governments that are not racist. It's the same kind of language we had with Trump, as an example. Why would some people migrate to a right-wing country that is going to treat them in dehumanizing ways? Well, their motivation is connected to their specific situations. In some cases, they have family members there. In some cases, it just so happens the opportunity came there. And in other cases, they vary. But in most cases, it's desperation.
Dr. Gordon there says that the immigration of Ethiopian Jews to territories occupied by Israel is out of desperation. Quite clearly, this is a case of jumping out of the frying pan into the fire. Now, before we wind up our interview, let's watch remarks by a high-ranking Israeli regime diplomat on Ethiopian Jews.
Many of them actually converted, or their parents converted to Christianity for various reasons. And now they wish to return to be part of the Jewish people. They are not considered as Jews, so they already live as Jews, but officially they are not yet converted, so they are not yet Jews.
Now, the Israeli regime has been airlifting Ethiopian Jews in pursuit of its settler colonial project in the occupied Palestinian territories, but says they are not Jewish enough. What's your take?
The people who have the power, who are hegemonic, are always saying that the people who don't have the power are not authentically who they are. But Ethiopian Jews know they're Jewish people. And Ethiopian Jews, and not only they, but many Jews I've met across the world, they know who they are. And in the end, if there's a state that's not going to recognize them, then look, they'll live elsewhere.
Thanks a lot for your insight, Dr. Gordon. Now, when we come back after a short break, we'll talk about dangers facing the Congo rainforest.
Zionist in peril.
The Congo Basin Forest is the world's second largest tropical rainforest, covering approximately 170 million hectares, that is more than four times the size of Germany. This forest is one of the most important places in the world to help reduce the effects of climate change. Now, Congo Basin Forest spans six countries, that is Cameroon, the Central African Republic, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Gabon, Equatorial Guinea, and the Republic of Congo. The Congo rainforest is also of critical importance to local populations.
So here we've got a peat sample from 2.5 meters to 3 meters deep. So it's a surprise to see such depths here, which suggests that possibly after some more exploration, we might have to revise our estimates of how much carbon is stored in this basin, in the central Congo basin, upwards a little bit.
In recent years, the rate of deforestation in the Congo Basin forest has increased at an alarming rate. According to Greenpeace Africa, illegal and unsustainable logging, compounded by weak forest management, has resulted in the average loss of 374,000 hectares per year. That's quite a massive loss. A community leader in the Democratic Republic of Congo laments here the loss of the forest cover in his village.
Moi, je dirais personnellement non. Je n'aurais pas signé parce que j'ai vécu, j'ai eu l'expérience par rapport à l'autre.
For an incisive analysis on what danger the Congo Basin faces due to deforestation, we are joined by Nimo Basse. He's an environmental activist, author, and director of Health of Mother Earth Foundation. Thanks a lot, sir, for your time. Now, how massive is the destruction of the Congo Basin rainforests?
The Congo Basin rainforest covers a wide area in a number of countries in the heart of Africa. It's the second largest tropical primary rainforest in the world. Compared to the rest of deforestation in other parts of the world, this used to be fairly low, especially when you compare to the deforestation in the Amazon. But of late, the rate of deforestation has been increasing, and this is very worrisome.
Thanks for that, Mr. Basse.
Since 2002, a moratorium on the allocation of new logging concessions has been in place in the Democratic Republic of Congo, a country in which most of the Congo Basin forest can be found. The moratorium doesn't mean an end to cutting of trees in the DRC, but it means that no new logging contracts can be awarded. Currently, illegal timber cut in the Congo Basin is being sent around the world, especially to the European Union member states and the United States. An environmental activist in Cameroon speaks on the need to combat after witnessing scenes of illegal logging.
Christian Louis Ndok, a community forest observer, and Pascal revisit an illegally felled and protected Bubinga tree, abandoned when the loggers were discovered. The felled tree is often left to rot, and denouncers get no reward.
What is the dominant force behind rising Congo forest deforestation?
There are many factors, really, multiple factors in deforestation in the Congo rainforest, but the major ones are industrial mining, especially, and this covers. There are many factors affecting and increasing the rate of deforestation in the Congo rainforest, including factors such as mining. And mining does have related factors, because before mining takes place, you have to build the access route to the mining locations, and this brings in a lot of other factors that lead to deforestation. There's also the case of industrial plantation. Agriculture, especially like oil, including oil palm plantations, and there's also massive logging going on.
Mr. Basse talked there about logging and agricultural projects. Now, Cameroon is one of the Congo Basin countries that has seen its forest cover diminish due to industrial scale farming. A local here speaks on how a multinational company has destroyed the tropical forest in his region. Mr. Basay, can you elaborate on how multinationals are destroying the Congo Basin forest through logging and massive agricultural projects?
Surprisingly, or would I say shockingly, industrial plantation owners prefer virgin forest rather than degraded forest because the soil is richer and they can just make grow their crops, plantation cash crops, without having to invest so much in soil preparation. So you have this problem as one of the big challenges that we can see in forest deforestation as well as forest degradation in the area. Big industrial infrastructure such as hydropower plants are equally creating serious problems. And these big plantations and big infrastructure also come up along with massive population movements. All these add together to create serious deforestation issues in the Congo Basin.
Well, thanks, Mr. Basay. It appears it's a tragic situation there at the Congo Basin.
In its projections, the United Nations says there will be a fivefold increase in human population in the Congo Basin by the end of the century. Use of charcoal by locals is a major contributing factor to the destruction of the Congo rainforest.
Despite this, illegal logging and land grabbing is a constant battle for the community. Nomejo's Baka Pygmy community have a naturally strong commitment to protect their forest, as it is a rich source of food and medicinal plants.
Some projections state that Congo Basin forest will disappear by the end of the century. In your opinion, is this possible?
Now, the projections that the Congo rainforest will disappear by the end of the century is really very scary and troubling. I don't think this possibility makes it inevitable that this must happen. The possibility is there, but it is not inevitable. We've also seen records that show if communities control and manage their forests, the rate of deforestation goes down and forests are preserved because local communities relate to the forest in a way that is not predatory. They relate to the forest in a way that is respectful of the multiple ecosystems in the forest. They depend on the forest for medicines, for food, for recreation, for spiritual activities. And they are the ones who defend and protect the forest. And so if we are conscious of the fact that this degradation is going on at a terrible rate that must be halted, one thing governments in the region can do is hand over the management of the forest to communities, and the forest will not disappear.
Mr. Basay says local communities should have the main stake in protecting the Congo rainforest to protect it from extinction. A community leader in Congo also believes they are the real custodians of the region's rainforest. Mr. Basay, as you know, the Congo Basin region has been experiencing political instability and armed conflicts for long. Now, how is this fragile political situation affecting the region's rainforest?
There's so much conflict going on, sometimes below the radar in the Congo Basin, because the Congo Basin has been a place of plunder of resources. Transnational corporations and governments have sponsored assassinations, sponsored conflicts, and just created instability in the region for decades now, also as to grab the resources from the Congo rainforest area. What citizens can do is to tell their politicians, tell their corporations, enough of the bloodshed, enough of blood minerals, enough of blood timber from the Congo Basin. It's time to halt the degradation and allow the planet, to allow the Congo Basin to revive itself and to have a rest from all the conflicts. This will be one way not only to tackle global warming, but also to build peace in a way that will affect everyone positively.
Well, very well put there. Stop the plunder of the Congo rainforest to tackle global warming and for peace to prevail. And that brings us to the end of our show today. On behalf of my colleagues here at Africa Today, it's goodbye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Rabbana, Rabbana.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
Rabbana, Rabbana, ya Rabbana.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program The Key here at IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Shiraz Agha. Thank you for joining us here today. As you know, in many Islamic countries and in Iran as well, the country which we are currently residing in, we are in the month of Ramadan. We would like to congratulate all of our listeners. Today we're going to be addressing a question regarding the holy month of Ramadan. The question is this, that we see that usually when the month of Ramadan approaches, there's always a lot of problems as far as the commencement of the month is concerned. Some people say that the month of Ramadan has begun, while other people deny it. They begin it on a different day. A lot of people ask a very practical question, and that's this. Obviously, these problems arise from the sighting of the moon, because, as you know, the Islamic calendar is a lunar calendar, and it's based on the phases, the successive phases of the moon. So a question that often arises in the minds of people is this. Wouldn't it have been easier and more practical to make the Islamic calendar a solar calendar? And in this way, a lot of these problems that arise as far as the determination and specification of the beginning and the ends of the Islamic months would have disappeared. So this is a question that's very general. It's not limited to this holy month, but obviously we see that because of the problem of fasting and then the celebration of Eid, we see that this problem manifests itself in this month, in this holy month of Ramadan, in a more acute fashion. Regarding this question, we can say this. A lot of our ulama have mentioned many reasons for why the Islamic calendar was made a lunar calendar and not a solar calendar. But if we wanted to mention one of those reasons, which is specifically concerned with the month of Ramadan, we might say this. If you take a look at the dispersion of the Muslims in the world, we see that Muslims exist in all places and in all countries. Some of them live in countries in the southern hemisphere, some of them live in countries in the northern hemisphere, some of them live in the east, some of them live in the west. And we know that the time periods of the day, the length of the day in these countries, it varies from place to place. So if we said that if God had made the Islamic calendar a solar calendar, what would it mean? It would mean that the month of Ramadan would always occur at a specific time, for always. I mean, it would always occur, like, for example, if you made it in January, it would always occur in January. If you made it in the winter, it would always occur in the winter. Right? And this would be almost an act of oppression, right, for people who lived in the warmer climates or closer to the equators. They would either be forced to move from that area, or they would, you know, have to continuously fast in the summer, and this would be difficult. But by making it a lunar calendar, right, the month of Ramadan fluctuates as far as the seasons is concerned, and it allows people respite, right, who live in different areas of the world. This is perhaps one of the reasons, one of the practical reasons why an Islamic calendar has been made a lunar calendar. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the reason why the Islamic calendar was made a lunar calendar, not a solar calendar, and how this ties up with the blessed month of Ramadan. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussain Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM, 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.